I'm Bob Prince, the voice of the Pittsburgh Pirates, and we're turning back the year so that you can recapture the most exciting moments in Pittsburgh baseball just as they happen. The seventh and deciding game of the 1925 World Series. Darkness, rain, and tension by the ton at Forbes Field. Last of the eighth, the bases are loaded with bucks, and Kai Kiter is at bat. Two out, Kiter hits a drive down the right field line. Two runs score, and the Pirates win 9-7. Oh, how sweet it was. Pirates, only team in baseball ever to win the series after being down 3-1. Impossible? Sure, they're the Impossible Pirates, and they played it that way for 60 incredible years. They won 4 National League pennants in 9 years, from 1901 to 1909 under Barney Dreyfus. Led by manager Fred Clark, sparked by Honus Wagner, everybody's all-time shortstop, Babe Adams and other greats. They played Boston in the very first World Series in 1903, dropping that one 5-3. Then they won the series in 1909, beating Detroit 4-3. And this is how J. Honus Wagner, in the twilight of his career as a Pirate coach, compared baseball as it was played in those days to the game of today.
Well, it was quite a difference now than seems the players right now. They've got a great system. Yeah, everybody knows his onions. In other words, teamwork's down pretty pat. And the player today, I think, is in the minor leagues, one thing is he don't get what they used to get in the minor leagues. All the minor league managers now want players who hit home runs, and the fans want a home run hitter. So they decided, the managers in the minor league decided that they'd keep up young fellows who can hit a long ball. In the old days, they had speed, and they bunted a whole lot, and they sacrificed a whole lot. And being a dead ball, of course, the outfielder didn't place it deep. And they could throw you out the plate unless you got a good start. And base running, of course, is a lost art. Very few good base runners now, they, on account of that long hit ball. And the manager figures, well, we won't send them down here. We got two long ball hitters at the back of them coming up, and so forth.
It was a long time, as baseball is measured, before the Pirates were to win another pennant after their World Series triumph over Ty Cobb and the Tigers in 1909.
16 years, to be exact. Meanwhile, the cries were, Lukey, 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 can't get him over. And put in Yellow Horse.
Yes, Paul Long, old buddy, and we weren't old enough to worry about it. But the first long dry spell entered in 1925 under manager Bill McKechnie. The dean of sports editors, Chet Smith, covered that 1925 series, and this is how he saw it.
Walter Johnson, the big train they called him, threw a five-hitter at the Pirates, and Washington won the first game 4-1. Vic Aldridge then evened it 3-2. Washington took the third game 4-3, and when Johnson came back with a six-hit shutout to win 4-0, it looked like the Pirates were dead. They were down 3-1, and no team had ever gone on to win the series under those odds. But the Bucks did the impossible. Vic Aldridge won the fifth game 6-4, and Ray Kramer chucked a six-hitter in the sixth for a tight 3-2 decision to tie the series at 3-3. The seventh game was played in horrible weather, rain by the buckets full. Aldridge, Johnny Morrison, Kramer, and Rube Oldham pitching for the Bucks, Johnson for Washington. The Pirates tied it up at 5-5 with two runs in the seventh. Roger Peckinpah, most valuable player in the American League that year, dropped Eddie Moore's pop fly. Moore then scored on Max Carey's third double of the game. Carey, the Pirate captain, batted a thumping 4-5-8 for the series. Pye Trainer tripled to right to score Carey with the equalizer, and Pye was thrown out at home. Washington scored a run in the top of the eighth. It was Peckinpah's home run to go ahead 7-6. Now it was right up to the Pirates. In the last of the eighth, Glenn Wright fouled to Joe Judge. With Stuffy Gillis up and the rain still coming down, Johnson asked for sawdust on the mound. He got it. McInnes flied to Sam Rice. With two down, Smith doubled to right. Amoliti ran for him, and then Carson Bigby, batting for Kramer, doubled to left, scoring Eady with the tying run. Moore walked. Carey grounded to Peckinpah, who committed his eighth error, a World Series record, which prompted the famous baseball writer to select Peckinpah as the National League's most valuable player. With the bases loaded, Kyler came up. The game was delayed until more sawdust could be brought out. After fouling off three pitches, Kyler, with a full count, sliced a drive to right. Three runners came across, but the ball had lodged in a canvas that was used to cover the infield and had been rolled across the right field line. So it was a ground rule, two-base hit, and Carey had to go back to third. Pooch Barnhart flied to Harris, and the inning was over. Then Oldham came in to pitch for the Pirates in the ninth. He struck out Rice, got Bucky Harris, the Washington manager, to line out to Moore, and Goose Goslin was called out on strikes. 5,000 fans waited outside for Kyler, carted him on their shoulders to his home, half a mile from the ballpark. John Heidler, the National League president, summed it up this way.
The Pirates are the greatest club I've seen in all of my years of baseball. The gamest of all clubs.
Just too bad old John wasn't around to see the 1960 Pirates.
The impossible 1925 Pirates, down 3-1, and the first team to come on to win the series after being that far out of it. Comedian, sportsman Joey Brown later told an inside story about that sensational but soggy finish in the rain. He had been criticized by a good friend, J.G. Taylor Spink, in the Sporting News for his part in the movie Elmer the Great. Spink claimed it was just too fantastic to imagine a baseball game being played in a driving rain.
This was Joe Brown's explanation and story he told Baseball Commissioner Ford Frick some years later.
We got the idea for the game and for the conditions in that game from a game played in the 1925 World Series between Pittsburgh and Washington in Pittsburgh. Very interesting part about that, Ford, was that I was talking to the trainer of the Pittsburgh club, man who was the trainer at that time, or rather the groundkeeper out here, and Hannes and a few, when they were up at San Bernardino a few years ago. Yeah. And I said, I remember the game so very well. And I remember that in the game, there was so much water on the infield. As a matter of fact, they had to turn the lights on under the stand to get the crowd out. You know, it was late. You remember. I know you covered.
Sawdust out there.
That's right. That's what I'm just going to speak about. That I told him, I said, I remember when Walter Johnson was out there that for five times during the ball game, they came out with a wheelbarrow full of sawdust and put it on the mound so he could stand up. The water was around the mound. And he said, yes, and I might call your attention. It's something you don't know. That every time before I took that wheelbarrow full of sawdust out to the mound, I run the hose on it good.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you should answer Taylor on that one, Joe, too. You know, a funny part of it is if we hadn't played that game in the rain, that final game of the World Series in 25, had we not played in the rain that day, they couldn't have played again for 17 days.
We wouldn't have played. I remember very well. Yes, sir.
On top of the world in 1925, the Pirates plunged to third the next year, torn by cliques and dissension, and manager Bill McKechnie walked the plank when the team failed to repeat.
Donnie Bush took over as manager, and the Pirates climbed back to the top of the National League again in 1927. The year Charles A. Lindbergh made the first nonstop flight across the ocean, and the United States sent the Marines to Nicaragua and China. Pirate fans wished the New York Yankees had been sent there too, because that's who the Pirates had to play in the 27 series.
Pirate hopes were high before that series. The Wainer Act, baseball's greatest brother act, was rolling in high gear. Paul Wainer, Big Poison, led the league with 380, and Brother Lloyd, Little Poison, hit 355. Pitcher Carl Hubbell, the giant meal ticket, later moaned, every time you pitch to the Pirates, you got one wiener on base and another at bat. Chet Smith, you covered that 1927 series. What happened there?
Well, the Yanks that year had a team that was known as Murderer's Row. Ruth, Gary, Musil, and Tony Lazzari. They set a league record with 110 victories. The Babe hit 356 and set the all-time record for home runs, 60. In my book, it was the greatest baseball team of all time. But actually, it was Yankee pitching that won the series. The Yanks swept the first three games. And the fourth game has been replayed over and over. With the score tied 3-3 in the last of the ninth, Combs walked. Mark Koenig bunted safely down the third base line. With Ruth up, John Milges let loose a wild pitch, advancing the runners. Then Ruth was passed intentionally, filling the bases. Lou Gehrig fanned, and so did Mustel. The crowd cheered Milges. But then, with Lazeri up, another wild pitch by Milges, and it was all over. But Johnny Gooch, the catcher that day, always said that it wasn't a wild pitch. It was a passed ball that lost the series for the Pirates.
The Pirates were murdered four straight.
And then it was 33 long and sometimes tortuous years before the Pirates were to get back on top of the National League again. They managed to hang in there in the first division for 12 straight years and were mighty respectable, finishing in the money 23 of 28 years until the roof caved in after World War II.
But before the Pirates hit bottom, there was a moment of near gold and glory in 1938 when Pie Trainer pulled a near miracle as player-manager. This is the way Chet Smith saw it.
We didn't have a good Pirate team in 1938, just a bunch of try guys who fought their way into first place on July 12th, held a five-game lead as late as September 8th, and almost stole the pennant. The Wiener Act was fading. We had no outstanding nine-inning pitcher, only Fireman Mace Brown, one of the first great relief pitchers. President Bill Benswanger felt so confident we would win the pennant that he invested almost $40,000 in a new press box. Then came that fateful afternoon of September 29th, and I'll never forget it. With first place at stake and the score tied 5-5 with the Cubs in Wrigley Field in Chicago, Gabby Hartnett came to bat in the last of the ninth. Brown was pitching. There were two out, none off. The count was two strikes, no balls. Brown delivered the third pitch, a letter high ball that didn't break down in the way as Brown wanted it to do. Gabby swung. The ball sailed out of Wrigley Field like a trophy looking for a museum. You just felt it rather than saw it. The Cubs won the game 6-5 and then went on to win the pennant by two games.
Suffering Catfish, that was a heartbreaker. And then, some years later, Joey Brown and Baseball Commissioner Ford C. Frick were discussing the 1938 season and talking about the great batting stars.
Those two little fellas that were with this ball club, the Wieners were great ball, greater ball players, and a lot of people appreciate. They were ball players. They could do everything, and seemingly, I see those two fellas up at the plate. Both of them had habits. One would put that bat almost down his back. Now, standing up there, and he looked as though he'd be but he was ready for that ball when it was pitched.
They lost a pretty tough chance to get into a World Series when that big guy came up there, and he told me himself he never saw that ball as it crossed the plate. He started across the plate, never did get across, but he hit that ball actually blind.
You know, the funny part of it was, Joe, that if Hartnett doesn't hit that ball, we've got to call that ball game that day. I was out there, and I thought the umpires carried a little too long anyhow, and another hitter couldn't possibly have come up. They'd had to call that ball game.
Pittsburgh hates to hear you say you thought they carried a little too long. We had that Forbes Field all set for that World Series, boy.
Yeah, I know, but
were printed, weren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You're still looking for a World Series button from that, Joe?
That's right. But they had them.
Roswell has one, and that, well, I was going to send one, but I can't get it away from Roswell.
Oh, my aching back was a familiar sound. And things got so tough for the Bucks of Rosie Roswell, then the voice of the Pirates, that he even talked about some other ball clubs. This was one of Rosie's favorite stories, told as only he, Rosie, could tell it.
Thanks a lot, and a cheery hello to you good friends of the air. One of the wise sages of another day one time said, there's a reason for everything, but everything is not reason. How right. But that brings me to an odd baseball story. You baseball fans who have patiently listened to my rantings for so many years may have wondered why I keep constantly playing the hunches as the pigeons come and hover around my broadcasting booth out at Forbes Field. Well, there's a story behind it. And I have to roll the curtain back about 14 years to pick up the connecting link between the pigeon and my good luck omen. The World Series in 1933 was played between the Washington Senators and the New York Giants. The Giants caught the first two games at the Polo Grounds and then moved over to Washington. The Senators took the first game in the National Capital, but the Giants took the next two and became world champions. Now let me get back to the pigeon. It was a chilly October day when they played that first game in Washington, but picking away at the sod directly back of shortstop, was a slate-colored pigeon that refused to move, despite the appeals of Joe Cronin, the Senator shortstop, and Blondie Ryan, the Giant shortstop. At the beginning of each inning, one or the other of those two defensive players would give the bird the bum's rush. But just as soon as the pitcher would toe the rubber again, back would come Mr. Pigeon and start grubbing for work. The first day, the second day, the third day, that pigeon was there. Finally, the umpire and the ball players all gave up and refused to even try to chase our young feathered friend. But I'll say this, outside of watching the ball, strikes, hits, and errors, there never was as much competition in a World Series game as that pigeon furnished for 3 days in Washington. At changing time in every inning, the fans would fasten their attention upon the pigeon playing in the backer-up position at shortstop. And the only time that bird would move a wing would be when a ground ball was hit past it, or when the shortstop would back up to take a little blooper. Then, and then only, would it lift itself aloft, only to return again as soon as play had resumed. The sequel? Yes, of course, there's a sequel. Let me run over hurriedly the details of the scoring in the final game. Hal Schumacher had started for the Giants, and Crowder was throwing him for the Senators. In the second inning, the Giants picked up two tallies when Schumacher drove out a single to send Travis Jackson and Gus Mancuso over the happy gum. They picked up another one in the sixth on a pair of doubles, but the Senators went to work in the last half of the sixth and tied it up. The game moved into the tenth inning when, with 2 men away, Little Mel Ott came up, got a hold of a fast pitch, and drove it out of the lot to win the ball game in the World Championship for the Giants. Oh, yes. What about the pitching? Well, when the last putout was made, Blondie Ryan, the Giant shortstop, reached in his hip pocket, pulled out a handful of corn, and dropped it on the ground. The pigeon came in a little closer to the infield. Blondie stooped over, picked it up, and carried it into the Giant clubhouse as the good luck charmer of the 1933 World Series. Yes, these ball players are a superstitious lot, and so are some baseball broadcasters. This is Rosie Roswell saying goodbye and wishing you well all along the way.
In 1948, the Pirates made a spasmodic lurch into the first division, finishing fourth, 8 1/2 lengths back. Billy Meyer was named Manager of the Year and richly deserved it. And that was the year the most famous play-by-play announcer in the history of baseball made his debut. Bing Crosby, Pirate stockholder, did it this way under the tutelage of Rosie Roswell in April of 1948.
Now Ralph Kiner standing by down there waiting for Doyle Lade, who's just taking over the pitching chores for the Chicago club. He's a right-hander, and Ralph Kiner will be the first man to face him. Lade last year was in there with an 11-10 record, 11 wins and 10 losses. D, you've been doing a grand job. I don't dare trust myself for this. Come right back.
Don't you think they're tired of my monotonous...
No, I'll never get a little bit of that. I'll stay right in there, Big.
Well, I'd like to see Ralph improve a little off his showing so far this afternoon against Rush. He couldn't do much, although he hit a hard smash to left field, which is taken by Averson. He's facing Doyle Lade now. Maybe he'll do a little better. And he does.
There goes one. You don't need a raise. Go in there, Anthony. There are close. Clear out over the scoreboard. Over into Shenley Park, a round tripper for Ralph Kiner, his first of the 1948 season.
Oh, did he?
Let's hope that it's the first of 61.
Oh.
And that'll bring a gallon of sealed test ice cream of the month to some shut-in here
Ralph
in Pittsburgh.
Ralph is beaming.
We'll be sending you a card along for that. His first home run of the 1948 season. Put the buckos in there. 3-0. I just had to take that, and Bing, because we got
a little
corn around here. We spread up his home run.
Well, Ralph was really beaming. The first pitch that Doyle Lade threw to him, he hit it right over the fence, the scoreboard, the clock, about 20 foot to the right of the clock, and about the same height as the top of the clock. I said that Pasco hit a hard smash here yesterday for the home run. May I tell you something? It was a swinging bunt compared to this that Ralph just hit. And the wind is blowing against us this afternoon when you hit the left field. The hardest smash I've seen in this park. I guess he hit a few last year just as hard as some of the other, but when he hit that, I knew it was a home run, no question.
That was hit with what they call authority.
Real hard hit ball. First pitch that Doyle Lade threw to him, he combed right over the left field, over the clock, over everything.
And that was the only time anyone ever took a mic away from Bing Crosby.
By the way, there was a second baseman in that game, and this is what Bing had to say about him.
It's a ground ball to Danny Murtaugh. He takes it on the big hop, tosses to third, that's all. And thank you, Ladies and gentlemen, for putting up with my announcing, I know it's not much good. Putz has run out to grab Riddle and gives him a big hug and a kiss for the beautifully two-pitched, two-hit game. Rip Sewell gets up out of the dugout and goes over to Elmer Riddle and puts his arms around him and gives him a big hug. Wonderful pitch game. Lots of control, lots of stuff on the ball. Confident all the time. Handled beautifully by Klutz and some wonderful plays in back of him, particularly by Rojek and Gustin. And Danny Murtaugh, who drove in the first run. Friends, it's been a real pleasure to appear here on this broadcast with Rosie and Bob Prince. Going east, I hope to get back for some of the home games, which start the 1st of May. I hope to be able to see you then and to talk to you over this microphone. I know you'll excuse my deficiencies as a radio broadcaster for baseball, but Rosie seems to think I bring him luck up here, and if I do, I'm only too willing to appear and contribute whatever I can to the color out here at Forbes Field.
In 1949, the Pirates fell back into the second division and finished 6th. There were some changes made in the 5-year program. The rookie tryout camp was launched in 1950. Here's how Frank McKinney explained the changes.
Well, as we indicated when we first took over the Pittsburgh Ball Club 3 years ago, we launched into what we thought would be a 5-year program. At that time, as you recall, Pittsburgh had little or no farm system. This is a game whereby you've got to develop your own talent. Certainly you can't buy star ball players. Nobody will sell you their stars. All you can hope to get is, shall I say, cast-offs. We immediately launched into the development of a farm system, which under normal circumstances would take 4 or 5 years. This year, we took the cream of our crop, so to speak, from our 13 farm clubs and had them out here in the hopes that by schooling them, they could advance for perhaps one classification in their development program. There were about 70 ball players in camp, and was agreeably surprised to learn to see that most of them had grown at least 2 or 3 inches in height since a year ago. And in my opinion, there are about at least 6 or 7 that will be ready for Pittsburgh within the next year to 18 months.
Well, now, Frank, of course, everybody in Pittsburgh has been tremendously interested in this bonus pitcher, young Lefty Pettit. When you met him, I presume you shook hands with him gingerly for fear you would damage him in some way. And I heard a remark that you said that if he didn't look good to you when you got there, you probably would shoot a couple of scouts. At least I thought you might have been quoted that way. Whether that was correct or not, I don't know. How did Pettit impress you, Frank?
Pettit has all the earmarks of being a major league pitcher. He has the poise, he has the physical ability, he has the stamina. In my opinion, the only thing he lacks is experience. I saw him pitch 3 innings Sunday, and with the possible exception of being a little stage fright, he had all the earmarks of being a left-handed feller, in my opinion. I think we're in for one of the most interesting years that we've had thus far. By that, I don't mean, and I'm not claiming to win any pennants, but I think definitely we're a first division ball club. I still will stand by my statement of asking the fans of Pittsburgh to bear with us for 5 years. At the end of 5 years or within the next 2 years, I'm definitely sure that we will have a 1-2-3 ball club. By that, I don't mean this coming year. But again, at the end of our 5-year probationary period, so to speak, I think we will be able to give a good accounting of ourselves.
But the luck of the Pirates was running all bad at that point. Paul Pettit came up with a sore arm and $100,000 went down the drain. The Pirates finished last that year for the first time since the First World War.
Late in 1950, John Galbraith took over and brought in Branch Rickey Sr., the creator of the farm system, as general manager. But for 8 agonizing years, the Bucks finished last or next to last. They tried everything from the youth movement to midget shortstops and even left-handed catchers. Ralph Kiner's home runs weren't enough to stem the tide of losses, even though he led the National League 7 times, hit a Pirate high of 54 in 1949, and racked up an all-time Pirate career total of 301. Joey Brown provided some comic relief during the dark days with this advice to the home run champion.
I've got to help that boy. That boy needs help. Yeah. Come here, Mr. Kiner, if you don't mind, old boy, come here. I want to help you. I want to help you with your hitting. You've got to pay more attention to Brown from now on. You've got to watch that first ball. Don't stare at the pitcher a little bit more. You're not staring him enough. Now, do you see what the St. Louis Browns are doing? You've got to do that, too. I could do that with you. Do you mind if I mesmerize you slightly? Are you going to go in today?
Well, yeah. I will if you can give me the
Are you
word.
Going? No, well, I could
I
give
I can't play today.
Well, never mind the swollen wrist. Let's get a swollen batting average. I mean, something. Forget about this kind of thing. I can do it to you, see, if you'll just pay attention. Look me right in the eye. Yes, you see, now we've got it. No, don't laugh. Now, let's go back again. This time, don't laugh. Look me right in the eye. Good, I've got you. It's 61 this year. Yeah, really, it is. Now, if you just pay attention, keep your mind on it, we'll do it. Don't just relax all the time, completely. I'm letting you ladies and gentlemen listening to this, you're very lucky. They're fortunate people, you know.
Yes, they are.
I'm taking this boy now, and you pay attention to me, Ralphie. Oh, let's not fiddle around. Look me smack dab, and you've got it.